Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Welcome to Health Chat. On the program today, we will look at the burden of cervical cancer in Africa. But first, the World Health Organization says it has given a first ever green light to a test for tuberculosis, a disease which killed 1.25 million people last year. Expert MTB-RIF Ultra, produced by US-based molecular diagnostics company Cepheid, is the first test for TB diagnosis and antibiotic susceptibility testing that meets WHO's pre-qualification standards, according to the UN Health Agency. WHO pre-qualification aims to ensure that key health products meet global standards for quality, safety, and efficacy. The test detects the genetic material of the bacterium that causes TB in spit samples and provides an accurate result within hours. The WHO says the accurate and early detection of TB, especially drug-resistant strains, is a critical global health priority. A clinic initiative in Kenya aims to provide health care to vulnerable mobile populations such as truck drivers and commercial sex workers. The goal is to combat the spread of disease across borders in Africa. Juma Majonga reports from transit town of Milongo in Kenya.
It's a beehive of activity at this health facility made of converted shipping containers in the middle of Milongo, Kenya, a town on the busy Nairobi-Mombasa highway. It's one of seven such clinics located in transit towns along the Northern Corridor Highway in Kenya and 50 others across Eastern and Southern Africa. The clinics are run by the non-profit North Star Alliance. They offer healthcare to mobile populations like truck drivers and sex workers and communities that interact with them. Henry Mwazige is a program manager at North Star Alliance.
As they move, again, the access to quality healthcare services reduces, and that's why you have to target them and bring those services closer to them so that they are able to actually help in reducing that chain of transmission or cutting off that chain of transmission.
Kenya's Ministry of Health says long-distance truck drivers and sex workers have a high prevalence of HIV and other sexually transmitted diseases. 75-year-old Patrick has been a truck driver for nearly 5 decades. We are not using his real name because he wishes to remain anonymous. Patrick says he tested positive for HIV after a work trip in Botswana. He had trouble accessing his medication in some foreign countries. But now, thanks to the network of North Star Alliance clinics, he is able to get his medications across borders.
Now I can just walk into any of their clinics with my card, and once I show them, they look at it and identify my type of medicine, and they give it to me. If it is 4 or 5, they know my prescription.
Catherine Wanja, a sex worker and peer educator in Milongo town, tells VOA that truck drivers are their best clients because they are well sensitized on preventive measures.
Truck drivers have their own families, so we have to use the protection to protect me and the client to protect his family.
To increase the reach, North Star carries out outreach services in collaboration with the communities. Eunice Mwikali runs a guest house and bar business in the area. She says the partnership between businesses like hers and the health facility has helped educate clients who are mostly truck drivers and sex workers.
For example, we advise them to use condoms, that is for protection. So we advise them to come to North Star because we have linked with them and they are offering free services. And if they're infected, we also tell them if they forgot their drugs to come to North Star, they can refill their drugs at any particular point.
North Star says it provided health services to more than 180,000 patients in the region in 2022, majority being drivers and commercial sex workers. Juma Majanga, VOA News, Milongo, Kenya.
Every year, the annual March for Babies in Washington, D.C. draws attention to critical maternal and child health issues, such as premature birth. People from all walks of life joined forces recently in the nation's capital for the event to help lower the incidence of maternal and infant mortality. Families, friends, advocates, and health professionals have gathered here in downtown Washington, D.C. for a common cause: to raise awareness and show support for the health and survival of mothers and infants. Launched more than 50 years ago by U.S. nonprofit organization March of Dimes, the annual March for Babies has become a symbol of hope and action in communities across the United States.
We are here because Zeta has a long-standing relationship with the March of Dimes. So we believe that marching helps to save babies' lives. We've done this for a long, long time. We raise money all over the country, all over the world, for this purpose. And so we come out in numbers to show our support. We know that with just a little bit of preventative care, babies can live and can thrive.
The World Health Organization says each year more than 300,000 women die due to complications of pregnancy and childbirth, and 2.5 million babies die during the first month of life. Data from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reveals that the U.S. is the country with the highest rate of maternal death of any high-income nation, and there are significant racial and ethnic disparities.
1 in 10 babies is born prematurely. Black babies are 2 times more likely not to make their first birthday. So we have a lot to do. Maternal death in this country is higher for black and brown moms. So you're talking about 2.4 times more likely.
March for Babies has garnered support from local businesses and corporate sponsors such as ASRC Federal.
One of the things that we love about the March of Dimes is the focus on maternal equity and health equity, and looking at how to support women, Alaskan Native women, women of color, in order to ensure that all moms and babies have a chance, a fighting chance.
For families who have experienced the challenges of premature birth firsthand, March for Babies is a chance to share their stories and advocate for better care.
We were not expected to deliver a baby that would be breathing on her own. She was actually supposed to not survive birth. And throughout the journey, like I said, 118 days in 2 different NICUs, in state and out of state. So having to navigate that, still working, we're both full-time workers, and having to navigate that has been an extreme journey. And it just, her care is different. We always have to be vigilant and remain, you know, always aware of like the changes in her body. Although she is the only surviving and thriving, the journey continues.
Participants like Jeffrey, who benefited from the care supported by March of Dimes, find the event deeply personal and meaningful.
I was born at 35 weeks and had to spend a week in the NICU. So I personally benefited from a lot of the science and research for treatments that the March of Dimes has funded over all these decades.
Alpha Phi Alpha is a fraternity, a social organization known as a Greek organization at a college or university for male students.
It is so important that we make the choices around healthy pregnancies and mothers being able to bring and deliver healthy babies. And the work that March of Dimes does is, I mean, it's critical to our future. So our fraternity had a history of understanding what it means to be servants of all, to not only understand their role as leaders, but also as partners.
I think it's important that we support in a number of ways, through our fundraising opportunities, because obviously healthy babies are brought about because mothers are doing the right thing to take care of themselves. We can also look at legislation and be in support of those issues that women are fighting for.
Fundraised during March for Babies each year helps provide services such as mobile health clinic for prenatal care, conduct research, and advocate for policies that promote maternal and child health. Lenore Moudou, VOA News. We turn now to cervical cancer. More than 85% of cervical cancer cases and deaths occur in low- and middle-income countries. And the World Health Organization says the disease burdens the most vulnerable groups. As the world marked the fourth anniversary of the launch of the global strategy to eliminate cervical cancer as a public health problem, the WHO says the disease is still the fourth most common cancer in women globally. Maureen Ojembo reports.
The WHO reports that the highest rates of cervical cancer incidence and mortality are in sub-Saharan Africa, Central America, and Southeast Asia. November 17th is observed as the Cervical Cancer Elimination Day of Action. This year's theme is Elevating Frontline Health Workers, Transforming Global Commitments into Life-Saving Actions. WHO Director General Tedros Ghebreyesus says frontline health workers play a vital role in shaping the delivery of effective interventions for cervical cancer prevention, treatment, palliative care, and survivorship care.
Years ago today, WHO and communities around the world made a historic commitment to eliminate cervical cancer, one of the few cancers that can be prevented and cured if detected early. The support of advocates, partners, and communities are driving progress towards our shared 90-70-90 targets of vaccination, screening, and treatment. To date, 144 countries have introduced the HPV vaccine into national immunization programs, and many are also rolling out next-generation diagnostics.
He was speaking in a video comment the WHO released. Even though cervical cancer is highly detectable and curable, the disease is still one of the most common cancers worldwide. WHO member states are tasked with ensuring 90% of girls are vaccinated with the HPV vaccine by the age of 15. 70% of women are screened using high-performance tests by the age of 35 and treating 90% of women with precancer and those with invasive cancer by 2030. Most cases are caused by human papillomavirus, which the HPV vaccine prevents. According to the WHO, regional differences in the cervical cancer burden are related to inequalities in access to vaccination, screening, and treatment services. Women living with HIV are six times more likely to develop cervical cancer compared to the general population.
While we are making progress, we still face huge inequities, with women in low-income countries bearing most of the burden. Only with strong leadership and sustained investment can we achieve our shared goal of equitable access for communities most in need. Together, let's make cervical cancer history.
The WHO calls for support from around the world to recognize and lift up the contributions of frontline health workers providing life-saving services to eliminate cervical cancer. For VOA Africa, I am Maureen Ojembo in San Francisco.
Cervical cancer is a tragedy that can be prevented, yet it claims the lives of 76,000 African women every year, most in their prime of lives. A new op-ed by Dr. Machidiso Moeti, WHO Regional Director for Africa, and Dr. Daniel Dulitsky, Regional Director for Human Development at the World Bank, outlines a bold vision for eliminating cervical cancer in the African region. For more insight on the burden of cervical cancer in Africa and steps to address it, I spoke with Dr. Sharon Kapambwe, Technical Officer for Cervical Cancer for WHO Africa Region for the East and Southern Africa.
So cervical cancer is cancer that begins in the cervix because we're having abnormal cells that are beginning to grow in the cervix. And the cervix is basically the mouth of the womb or the entrance of the womb in a woman from the outside, from the vagina, we must say. And because it starts on the cervix, that is why it's called cancer of the cervix. And when we see that we had over 600,000 cases in 2022 globally, and we had over 300,000 deaths globally as well. But peculiar that we must mention is that we see that in Africa, there is a disproportionate proportion of women who are getting cancer of the cervix in Africa. So cervical cancer, out of the 20 highest burden countries with the highest rate new cancer cases, 18 of those are in Africa. And we recorded over 110,000 new cases in 2022 and over 70 1,000 deaths that we had. So when you look at the contribution, about a quarter of the deaths that we're getting globally are coming from Africa. You find that over 85% of the cases of cervical cancer are in low to middle income countries. So women living with HIV are 6 times likely to develop cervical cancer. So when we see that and we look at Southern Africa in particular, you will see that there is this overlapping of seeing where there's high HIV burden, also seeing high cancer of the cervix.
You talked about the issue with HIV/AIDS. We know about the human papillomavirus. What are some of the causes?
Almost 99% of cervical cancer cases are due to HPV. So HPV is a sufficient cause for cancer of the cervix, but there are also other factors in the human body that will lead somebody to be susceptible to cancer of the cervix. So when we look at who is getting, we've already brought out issues of immunity. So compromised immunity is going to bring out issues of cervical cancers. It's not only HIV. It could be people who are already getting another treatment for cancer that can be hit. But still, the underlying is that somebody must first have the HPV. And then with the HPV are the predisposing factors that are coming in. So we talk about early sexual debut. That is really because the cervix is not yet well developed in the younger women. And you find that they can easily get this infection. And then we also see that when I say multiple partners, it really has to be qualified, is that any encounters, even somebody who just having sex is enough for you to be able to get the HPV. The good thing is that it is not everybody who gets HPV who ends up with cancer of the cervix. Most of the cases of cancer of HPV infection will clear on their own. So you'll find that women can clear by 18 months, they will clear this infection. But there are those women who end up with persistent infection. And those who are ending up with persistent infection is because of what we have talked about, that either they have, you know, other underlying causes, like somebody could be having a life-changing disease like kidney. They could be on treatment for cancer itself, that the immunity is weakened. And there could be somebody who's living with HIV as well, that they will also have some form of transient or immunity which is compromised. So because of that, we see that the main issue that we deal with is HPV, the human papillomavirus. And that's why you see interventions around cancer of the cervix around the HPV virus.
What is the first sign, or what are the first signs of cervical cancer, and what is the best age to start a screening?
To begin with, when you get the HPV infection, so HPV is predominantly sexually transmitted. And when you get HPV, you have an HPV infection, like I mentioned, and you have this persistent infection. With persistent, the women who have persistent infection have a likelihood to develop cancer of the cervix. So when we look at who should be screened and how screening comes in, HPV infection is one of the infections that takes long from the time a woman gets the HPV infection to the time she actually gets the cervical cancer. It can take over a decade of that woman having that. Of course, there has been seen that there's a faster rate of developing cervical cancer in women who are living with HIV. So when you say, what are the symptoms? Even when I get the HPV infection, you will not feel anything. There are no symptoms for that high risk causing HPV infection to cause any symptoms. Even the early cervical cancer has no symptoms. But once we start seeing symptoms, some of the common symptoms that the woman will talk about is unusual bleeding. And by unusual bleeding, we see a woman is bleeding after having sex, what we call postcoital bleeding. We see a woman who's bleeding in between her menses or developing heavier menses. We see a woman who is postmenopausal, meaning they've reached menopause and they are no longer having their menses, but they end up having bleeding, vaginal bleeding, which is coming in. So that is one. Unusual bleeding, abnormal bleeding, and bleeding between menses, bleeding, heavy bleeding. You get bleeding after sex and bleeding when you have already reached menopause. The other symptom that we'll see is that there is vaginal discharge. This is copious. It's a lot of vaginal discharge, which comes with a bit of bad smell. It's a fast smelling, so that you will note that this is not the usual mucus that women will develop in their reproductive tract, which protects them. But this is a foul smelling discharge. So those are some of the symptoms. And of course, we'll see some of the symptoms that are coming in of lower back pain that women will complain about, pain in the leg. And some of this pain in the leg is beginning to show that probably the cancer is moving to other parts of the body.
Let's talk about prevention. HPV vaccine has been recommended to prevent. How does the single dose HPV vaccine recommendation impact vaccination campaign and access for women to have this means of prevention?
So the HPV vaccine is, and it's prophylactic, meaning that we're giving it to somebody who has, it's preventing you from getting the HPV. So single dose is a game changer. Remember, from the introduction of national introduction from as early as 2018, we have seen that there has been challenges in the HPV vaccine for it to meet all the national introductions that we are getting. Mm-hmm. And the recommendation previously was two dose. And then initially we started with three doses, but as science starts getting more answers, we move to two doses. And now WHO has recommended that one dose is safe and efficacious as well. So it's safe and effective as a two dose. This is a game changer. This means that we're getting more girls vaccinated in the background of these challenges that I've mentioned of production, of getting, you know, all the girls getting vaccinated. It means that we are adding, actually, when we see that in 2022, we had about 37 countries that were in 2023, by end of 2023, we had about 37 countries that had moved to single dose. By the time we're in 2024, we've seen that we've gone to over 50 countries that have introduced single dose. And we've had an additional 6 million girls that have been vaccinated because of that. So that means that we're increasing access for the number of girls who get that. And you will see in most of our countries, when we look at the data that we have from HPV vaccination, is that we will see a high, we see a high coverage at first dose, but we will normally see a drop in the second dose in most of the countries. So this also goes to show that since we've seen that a single dose is effective, it means that we'll see most of the girls getting this access at a high rate. And at the end of the day, it's more girls protected, more future mothers protected, more lives that are being saved.
What treatments are available for cervical cancer and how accessible are these treatments for lower income communities?
So we see that if we look at our region in particular, the WHO African region, and we look at the global strategy that WHO had launched in 2020, which is what we call the 90-70-90, that 90% of the girls should are vaccinated by the age of 15. And we have 70% of women who are screened with a high performance test by 35 and 45 years of age. And then we get 90% of women treated for pre-cancer and invasive cancer as well. So when we look at how we've fared, looking at from the time we had the global strategy, even the framework for implementation of the strategy for the African region, we will see that 29 countries have introduced HPV vaccination. And then we see that we're lagging behind on the screening. 34 countries are having some form of screening, but only about 20 have introduced some form of HPV testing, which is needed. And we can discuss the issues of access for that. When a woman is found with cancer of the cervix, with the two modalities that are going to be there, depending on the staging, on how the disease is spread out, there's surgery, which is there. There's also radiotherapy. The mainstay for invasive cancer of the cervix is radiotherapy. If a woman cannot have the surgery. But what we see, only over 30 countries have access to radiotherapy. And I must mention that I told you in the beginning that 18 countries with the highest burden, the top 20, 18 are in Africa, and 9 of those countries do not have access to radiotherapy. And remember, most of the women in our setting in low to middle income countries are presenting late. It's one of the challenges is late presentation. So because these women are coming late, and then we find that if out of those top 20, 9 of those in our region in particular do not have access to radiotherapy. So that's a challenge. We do not have human resource. You need specialized human resource for somebody who has invasive cancer of the cervix for surgery. We do not have enough gynecologic oncologists who can be able to manage these women to do the surgery. And then even where we have, this treatment is usually based in urban areas. So you will see that the rural women who are far-fetched will have to travel distances to be able to access this treatment. And it's not treatment that they'll be able to have over a day and then they go back. They have to stay there. So they are coming into a known territory, usually in the capital. So we have an equal distribution of human resource. We have issues of skill. So treatment is hampered because we do not have enough human resource that is skilled enough to be able to carry out the surgery. We do not have enough radiotherapy machines. Even in Africa, where we're having about 32 countries having, you find that most of these countries are in the southern part of Africa. And so there's a lag that is going on in the WHO region that the southern Africa has more radiotherapy access than the west part of Africa as well.
Looking ahead, where do you see the priorities in tackling cervical cancer in Africa?
I think if you look at the challenges that we have and looking at them from the challenges that we present, first and foremost, we look at our health systems that are still inadequately prepared to handle issues of cervical cancer. I talked about human resource. We need to look at human resource and try to see how we can be able to have more of the skilled labor that is there. But the skilled labor should not just end at those who already have invasive cancer of the cervix. We need skilled labor from vaccination. We have enough nurses who should be able to vaccinate the girls. We have enough nurses who should, nurses or whichever cadre is being used in that country, I must qualify, should be able to do the screening. And we must have enough who are able to perform surgery. And we must look at equity. That where we're setting up these centers, we're taking into consideration the women who are coming from very far areas. If we can't put it in the rural area, we have to put in incentives of how a woman is going to reach that capital and how she'll be able to access radiotherapy, because on our own, that gets you see that a lot of people who are having cancer in general have a lot of out-of-pocket spending. The other issue that we need to look at is financing. Cervical cancer is still underfinanced. We do not have enough financing, domestic financing, meaning that governments are still not putting in a lot into cervical cancer, into the various interventions that we are looking at. And if we're looking at reaching the 70-90 by 2030, it means that we need to have more domestic funding to begin with. And that we should also have more donor funding that is coming into areas like cervical cancer. This will help to reduce the out-of-pocket spending. Also, universal health coverage is about financial protection. So it means that we must be able to protect these women who are coming in. And sometimes I think we look at cervix just from the disease and the treatment, but we must also be able to look at the socioeconomic impact that this disease has. And apart from that, we need to look at late presentation. Why are women coming late? Part of it is because there's no access to screening where they are. There's no access to treatment. But it's also that there are many myths and misconceptions that are going on still in our communities. We need to have education. We need not education. It has to be engagement with the communities. We need to bring in much more other people to the table than just the medical people or the people in the health sector. We're talking about religious leaders getting involved, traditional leaders getting involved, trying to make sure they understand what this disease is about and what impact it has when women have this disease. So we have to have a broad range of stakeholders who are sitting around the table who are able to help. Imagine if we get a Catholic priest or we get who is involved in this and they are found everywhere, or any other religion that we can think about. It could be Islam. It could be these are people who are respected in their community and that is a voice people can listen to. That is a voice we need to train. That is a voice that needs to start speaking, because we're talking about women dying. And I think from the religious perspective, that is something that is critical for them to ensure that women are safe.
Dr. Sharon Kapangwe, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a delight to talk to you today.
That was Dr. Sharon Kapangwe, Technical Officer for Cervical Cancer for WHO Africa Region for the East and Southern Africa. That is all for this edition of Health Chat. Thank you all for joining us, and thanks to all our affiliate stations throughout Africa for carrying Health Chat. I'm your host, Lino Khumudu, with producer Mukbili Abaro.